Calling case number A210571, Brianna Marie Borth, appellant versus Matthew Joseph Borth, respondent.
Excellent. Welcome. Obviously, we're conducting this oral argument remotely through Zoom. And so if at any time during the argument, if you're having technical difficulties or if you can't hear any of us, just let us know and we'll get things fixed as quickly as possible. Each side will have 15 minutes. And appellant will have 5 minutes for rebuttal. So please proceed and state your name for the record, because an audio recording will be available after the hearing. So please go ahead.
Good morning, thank you. May it please the court and counsel. My name is Danielle DiFiore and I represent the appellant in this matter, Brianna Borth. This appeal stems from a district court's denial of my client's request for a harassment restraining order by improperly applying the harassment restraining order statute, Minnesota Statute 609.748, Subdivision 1. On February 2nd, 2021, appellant filed a petition for harassment restraining order based on several allegations. The only allegation at issue here is that respondent disseminated a private sexual image of appellant to a third party without her consent. The petition was granted on an ex parte basis on February 4th, 2021. On March 10th, 2021, this matter came before the district court. It was undisputed at the evidentiary hearing that respondent disseminated a nude photo of appellant to a third party without her consent. Specifically, he sent a screenshot of a Snapchat message that was sent to him to appellant's significant other. The court found that respondent engaged in a single act of non-consensual sexual dissemination of a private image under Minnesota Statute 617.261. However, the court misapplied the law. In its ruling, the court stated that respondent did not disseminate the image for the purpose of adversely affecting the privacy or security of Ms. Borth, but instead did it as a way more to maybe hurt Ms. Page, who's the new significant other, and let her know what was going on. The requirement to have repeated, the court misapplied Minnesota Statute 609.748, Subdivision 1A1. The harassment restraining order statute defines harassment in four specific ways. One, a single incident of physical or sexual assault. Two, a single instant harassment under Section 609.749, Subdivision 2, Clause 8. A single incident of non-consensual dissemination of private sexual images under Section 617.261. And repeated instances of intrusive or unwanted acts, words, or gestures that have a substantial adverse effect or are intended to have a substantial adverse effect on the safety, privacy, or security of another. The court applied the intent to have a substantial effect on the safety, security, and privacy of another to the third definition of harassment, a single incident of non-consensual dissemination of private sexual images. It is not required to have the intent to have a substantial adverse effect on the safety, security or privacy of another.
Counsel, would you agree that the issue in this case boils down to whether the phrase that, or the clause that have a substantial adverse effect or are intended to have a substantial adverse effect on the safety, security or privacy of another, whether that clause modifies just the preceding conduct, repeated incidents of intrusive or unwanted acts, words, or gestures, or whether it modifies all of the conduct in the list, the four different types of conduct in paragraph one. So basically, whether that clause is limited in its modification or whether it applies to all the different items in the list.
Yes, Your Honor, I would say that is the issue here.
And so, and then just following up on that, the items in the list, there's three different types of single conduct listed, and then it's or repeated incidents. So that's a disjunctive list, correct?
Correct.
And then repeated incidents is a references plural acts, and then the modifying clause that have substantial adverse effect, that verb have is plural as well. So right. Logically, when I read this, and this is just my view, but it seems that just under accepted rules of grammar, the only logical reading is that that clause modifies only repeated incidents, because a single incident is the other items in the list are singular incidents, and a single incident, it's not logical to read it as a single incident of non-consensual dissemination of private sexual images that have a substantial adverse effect, because then you'd be mixing a single action with a plural modifying clause. And just grammatically, that doesn't seem to work to me. But can you address that?
Yes, Your Honor, I agree with you. So this statute, the word or, clearly separates the two categories of what harassment is. So the first part of the statute is divided into the three acts. So the physical or sexual assault, a single incident of harassment under section 609, or the dissemination of a private image. Then it is separated into a second clause, or repeated, intrusive, unwanted acts. So those two things are separate. And so the language that the intent to have a substantial adverse effect or intended to have a substantial adverse effect only modifies the repeated instances of intrusive or unwanted acts. I don't think this law is ambiguous. I think there's only one plain reading of this law. The only reading of it is that the second part, the substantial adverse effect, modifies only repeated instances of intrusive unwanted acts.
Does that make any sense, however? What you're saying is that a single act does not require the have an intent to substantially adversely affect safety or whatever, but that multiple acts requires an intent. It seems to me like that is sort of backwards. Why would the legislature say a single instance is sufficient, but if it happens a number of times, then you have to have the intent of having a substantial adverse effect. Does that make any sense?
I would argue that's exactly what the intent is. Sorry?
Go ahead.
I'm sorry, you started freezing. I apologize.
Yeah, I'm sorry.
It's okay. So I would say that's exactly right. So the legislator points to a criminal statute when discussing both the sexual assault and the dissemination of private images. So when looking at that criminal statute, there's you need to show that the person is identifiable from the image itself, the person depicted in the image or by another person, or from personal information displayed in connection with the image. The actor knows or reasonably knows that the person depicted in the image does not consent to the dissemination, and the image was obtained or created under circumstances in which the actor knew or reasonably should have known the person depicted had a reasonable expectation of privacy. So this is a separate category of an offense versus the repeated instances of intrusive unwanted acts. They're separated by the phrase or. So yes, I would say that the legislator intended that. So if you do this once, send a sexual image once, that's inherently an invasion of privacy. And they point to the criminal statute, which elaborates on the criteria of what constitutes non-consensual dissemination of a private sexual image. Does that answer your question?
I think so. Not sure. Go ahead.
Counsel, does the series qualifier rule support respondent's interpretation and the district court's interpretation. Am I reading it incorrectly because of that rule?
No, the series qualifier rule does not apply here. The series qualifier rule applies to an easily digestible series of nouns. So an example of that would be the State v. Stay case, where the court determined that the reasonable interpretation is that, this is where the court, I'm sure you know, addressed the first degree manslaughter statute. But in that case, you had one verb followed by a long preposition. So it was determined that's a non-parallel series, which is similar to what we have here versus the Khalil case, where you had an easily digestible series of nouns. So a person under the influence of alcohol, comma, or narcotic, comma, anesthetic, comma, or any other substance, comma, administered to that person without the person's agreement, lacks the judgment to give reasoned consent. That is an example of the series qualifier rule, because there's a straightforward parallel construction that involves all the nouns in a series and it was set apart by a comma. Here we have two separate distinct categories. We have the dissemination of private sexual images or repeated instances of intrusive or unwanted acts, comma, words, comma, or gestures that have a substantial adverse effect or intended to have a substantial adverse effect on safety, security, or privacy. If that phrase intended to have a substantial adverse effect was to apply to all the other acts within the statute, it would be set aside by a comma, which it's not here. Here, I think it's quite clear that that language only applies to the language following the or clause, because they're two separate and distinct categories as enumerated under the harassment restraining order statute.
Counsel, can you address appellant's argument about the definition of harass as found in, I believe it's 617.261?
I'm sorry, can you...
I think respondent argues that that definition, if we look to that definition defines harass as an act that would cause a substantial adverse effect on the safety, security, or privacy of a reasonable person. And I believe respondent can correct me if I'm wrong, but I believe respondent's arguing that that definition suggests that the similar language in this definition of harassment in 609.748 should also be read to apply that the language regarding safety, security, and privacy of another to all of the types of conduct listed in A1.
So I would say that the single incident of non-consensual dissemination of private sexual images points to the criminal statute 617.261. However, what we are evaluating right here is 609.748 as far as the definition of harassment as it pertains to a harassment restraining order. I still think if the court or if the legislator's intent was for that language to apply to all of the series, it would have been set apart by a comma or clearer language. Here, that's not the case. It points to a criminal statute. So you need to meet the elements of the criminal statute for it to qualify as harassment. And those three elements I just read to the court, which were, it was undisputed that this was a private sexual image that was disseminated to a third party. So here we're reviewing the harassment restraining order statute in a civil context, which is different than reviewing it in a criminal context. I think this might be a question more appropriate for the respondent. If that's...
Well, so in reading the judge's opinion, am I correct that the judge is pointing to the subjective intent of respondent here? And
yes.
Doesn't the definition of harass in 617.261 focus on the victim? And it's a reasonable person standard, right?
Yes. Again, we're reviewing a criminal statute versus a civil statute. And here,
but it looks like the legislature clearly at some point adds with the intent to have an effect, and at another point does not have that language. So why is there a difference?
Well, if you look at the legislative history of this, it's always been separated by that or clause. In 2016, that's when the single incident.
I don't want to spend my whole life arguing about commas. I'm talking about what is the legislature trying to do here by having in within specific reference to intent to have a substantial effect at one location, but not have that language at another.
Well, it's inherent.
In other words, one focuses, as I think Judge Siegel just suggested, on the perpetrator's state of mind. The other one focuses on the impact on the victim. Is there some rational reason why the rational reason? Is there some rationale for that kind of statutory framework?
Well, the dissemination of private sexual images is inherently an invasion of privacy. So the court has established the 617.261 statute.
So therefore the intent of what the perpetrator was doing is important or unimportant?
Well, I think it's important, but at the same time, it's a series of three qualifications. And if the actor knows that he was doing this and disseminating the images, it meets the statutory criteria. That inherently, obviously, invades someone's privacy when their sexual image is disseminated to a third party. It's inherently intrusive.
Without regard for what the intent was.
Correct.
Okay, any further questions from the panel? Because I see you're out of time. All right, Mr. Kuhn, go ahead and please introduce yourself for the record.
Thank you, Your Honors. My name is Christopher Kuhn. I'm with the law firm of Rustovich, Braun & Associates. And in this matter, I represent the respondent, Matthew Joseph Borth. May it please the court and counsel. Before arguing the finer points of grammatical interpretation, I would also note that the factual record before the district court also indicated that the appellant had filed a petition seeking a harassment restraining order against the respondent on the basis of, in addition to the comments noted by counsel, that she was forced into a coercive sexual encounter with the respondent. However, under cross-examination, she also admitted that the encounter itself was consensual, that she invited the respondent to the location where the
counsel, that issue isn't on appeal here, though, correct?
Well, I would submit to the court that it is, not with regard to the specific conduct forming the substantive question, but also to the extent to which the court may or may not have abused its discretion in denying the respondent or the appellant's request for a harassment restraining order.
Asked that this court reverse that first finding of the district court. So to the extent we were to agree with appellant, I don't think we would address that issue in any manner. So I guess I'm still not following why it's relevant.
I would argue that it is relevant to the extent that even if a respondent is able to establish and meet the statutory criteria for what constitutes harassment, the court may nevertheless decide not to issue a harassment restraining order based on its view of the petitioner's credibility and their observations of the petitioner's conduct.
But we have case law that says the trial court can't exercise that discretion by misapplying the law. Isn't that true?
The court does abuse its discretion if it incorrectly applies the law. But I would submit that even if the appellant's argument as to the first issue is agreed with by the panel, that the appellant did meet the statutory criteria for harassment, and the court nevertheless was justified in not issuing a harassment restraining order. With the court's leave, then I will return to the question. I think that is really the focus of this appeal, which is the extent to which.
Wait. So, can I ask you a quick question, though? So, you're saying that if we agree with appellant's interpretation of the statute and think that the district court committed an error of law, then we need to reverse and remand. Correct? I mean, is that, it just raised, because you're saying, wait a minute, there's other grounds, and so we could just deny it regardless. That it seemed to be that, I'm just trying to figure out what you're arguing there.
Yes, Your Honor. My respondent's position is that as a separate and independent basis for affirming the court's decision, without regard to the court's conclusion on the first point, that even if that were to be found in appellant's or under appellant's interpretation of the statute, the court's, I think the record is clear, determination that the appellant's credibility was or was so not credible that it, even if the appellant's interpretation it was correct, the district court was within its discretion not to issue a harassment restraining order. And I guess on that point, I will, the remainder of my comments will rely on the brief submitted. With regard to the first point, however, and the issue that I think is primarily the focus of this appeal, respondent submits that the court should apply the series qualifier canon to the entirety of subsection or subpart one of subsection one. Subsection one is divided into three discrete parts.
Okay, can I ask you a question? Because we've had a lot of commas here and there and this and on this calendar. So if I could just interrupt, sorry, so if I could just interrupt with the question.
Of course.
So dissemination, non-consensual dissemination of private sexual images, that's a gross misdemeanor crime, correct? And so why does your argument make any sense at all that somebody can be convicted of a gross misdemeanor crime, but the court is without authority to issue a harassment restraining order for the very same offense? It makes no logical sense to me. So help me out.
Yes, Your Honor. I would submit that it makes sense because they are separate questions. Whether a crime has been committed versus whether someone is engaged in harassment. And harassment restraining orders are enforceable by criminal prosecution. And the respondent's position is that the series qualifier rule is part of subpart one, which is separate from the other parts, which do not.
Counsel, then you're asking us to apply rules of grammatical construction, correct?
That's right.
And that rule, I think case law makes clear that rule applies only when there's a straightforward parallel construction that involves all nouns or verbs in a series. Here, help me out, but it doesn't seem to me that we have a straightforward construction. Parallel construction, because the first three items reference a single incident of physical or sexual assault, a single incident of harassment under section 609.749, and third, a single incident of non-consensual dissemination of private sexual images. And then the last item is a plural item that is repeated incidents of intrusive or unwanted acts. So it doesn't seem to me that we have parallel construction here, but am I wrong?
Respectfully, I would disagree, Your Honor, and say that under the canon cited by respondent, because the entire list is separated by commas, that notwithstanding the presence of the word or, it is designed to read as one contiguous list. And I would also note that there was another or within subpart one, between the words acts, I believe is acts or gestures. The appellant hasn't argued that the phrase at issue applies to gestures, but not words or acts.
Well, acts, words, and gestures, that's a parallel construction, those three. Would you agree to me that have is plural? Would you agree with me that the word have as used in that modifying clause is a plural word?
Yes, Your Honor.
And that a single incident is a singular noun phrase?
Yes, Your Honor.
So there's a disconnect there between using a plural verb in the modifying phrase that that have a substantial adverse effect or are intended to have a substantial adverse effect, using that with a single incident. Grammatically, isn't that correct?
I would agree that the numerical structure is different. That's right. But nevertheless, the respondent maintains that because it's contained within a continuous list of, the legislature had every right and possibility to separate out the different components of subpart one, as it did for subparts two and three, separated by semicolons, but it didn't.
It had intended that phrase that have a substantial adverse effect or are intended to have a substantial adverse effect, if it intended that phrase to apply to all the conduct listed in paragraph one, wouldn't it have used the word and instead of or between the last single incident and repeated incidents? Because or is a disjunctive term that separates that creates alternatives rather than a combination. And grammatically, it seems to me, if we were to accept your argument, it would only make sense if the word and was there rather than or.
I apologize. I'm not sure which specific spot in the subpart you're referring to.
Sorry, it's a long paragraph. So after the last, after the single incident of non-consensual dissemination of private sexual images, which is what we're talking about here, under section 617.261, comma, or repeated incidents, seems to me to accept your interpretation, we would need to read that to mean and rather than or. That if the legislature intended what you were suggesting, they would have used the word and rather than or there.
I respectfully, I guess, would take a different interpretation, Your Honor, and would suggest that if they had used the word and there, then in order to meet the requirements of subpart one, a petitioner would have to show every single piece of that.
Well, that's true. You're right. Phrase. That's a good point. But I still get stuck with the idea that these are, to your point, then these are different types of conduct, right? And you only need to show one, to your point. So then why say that have if it's a single incident? The legislature knows basic rules of grammar. And I it's hard for me, especially going back to Judge Siegel's earlier question, to imagine that they intended that language to apply in a manner that doesn't work grammatically.
Your Honor, I would submit that the have, being a plural tense there, is it designed to encompass not only the immediately preceding clause about acts, words, or gestures, but also the other component parts of subpart one. And for that reason is framed in the plural phrase rather than the singular. And to the court's earlier question, I would agree that it doesn't necessarily make as much sense to require the intent at issue here on part of this, part of the conduct described in part one, but not the other. And for this reason, and for the additional reasons cited in respondent's brief under the serious qualifier canon, submit that it should apply to all of the conduct described in subpart one, because it's merely connected by commas, not broken out into further discrete parts. For that reason, the phrase modifies all the conduct described in part one. And I think with that, unless there are further questions, that encompasses the respondent's position and any other issues, I guess, the respondent would rely on its brief and waive the rest of its time.
All right, any other questions for Mr. Kuhn? All right, Ms. DeFiore, you'll have 5 minutes for rebuttal. So proceed when you're ready.
Thank you. I think it's clear here that the district court misapplied the law. There's two separate distinct categories as a part of the 609.749 separated by an or. The qualifying phrase, substantial adverse effect on one's safety, security, or privacy, only modifies repeated instances of intrusive or unwanted acts. If the legislature wanted that phrase to apply and they intended for it to apply to the entire statute, there would have been an and. However, they used the word or. The purpose of statutory interpretation is to look at the plain meaning of the statute and not rewrite it. And essentially what respondent is requesting is for the statute to be rewritten. This statute's not ambiguous, but even if the court did find it to be ambiguous, the last antecedent rule should apply, which instructs that the limiting phrase modifies only the noun of the phrase it immediately follows. And that's the rule that should be applied here. This is not a parallel series of nouns. These are separate and distinct categories, which are separated by the word or, not and. Unless you have any further questions, I have nothing further.
Counsel, I have one final question for you. In your brief, I believe that you requested that this court reverse and remand for a new hearing. If we were to agree with your interpretation, would it be appropriate to simply reverse and remand? It's unclear to me why there'd be a need for a new hearing. And maybe I misinterpreted your brief, I'm sorry.
Well, I think it would need to be reversed and remanded because the harassment restraining order was granted on an ex parte basis. So then when we are going to the hearing, that's where the petitioner proves up her petition if a hearing is requested. So I think a new hearing would have to be ordered in order to have the harassment restraining order granted based on these facts in a permanent way. Does that answer?
We wouldn't. So if we were to agree with you, we wouldn't be making a decision whether or not it should be granted. We would just be concluding that the district court erred in its interpretation of the statute.
Correct.
And then on remand, it would be up to the district court how to proceed, consistent with the correct interpretation of the statute.
Correct.
And following your interpretation of the statute, the trial court could still decide to exercise its discretion. Is that correct?
That is correct. But in this case, I'm focusing on the one portion of the statute where the law was clearly misapplied, which is a basis for a harassment restraining order. And it was the basis for which it was denied. The order and the ruling from the bench made it clear that the order was not granted because she thought that the dissemination of the photo was not with the intent to have a substantial adverse effect on one's safety or privacy. That's how the judge ruled from the bench. And that is what paragraph 2 of her order states. So this
was after an evidentiary hearing, though. Is that right? Or am I totally confused about the procedural posture?
There was an evidentiary hearing, yes. So it was.
Yeah. So if we reverse on that issue and the district court found that 216.71, I may not have the right statute in front of me, but that the non-consensual dissemination of a sexual image, that was violated, then the district court would be required by the law, I mean, by the harassment, you'd say that the district court would be required to grant the order, correct?
Correct.
Okay. All right. I was just confused. All right. Any other questions? Seeing none, the case is now submitted. Thank you very much for your argument, and we will issue our opinion within the statutory timeframe. So thank you both very much.
Thank you.
Thank you, Your Honor.